From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, how community organizers beat the city of Corpus Christi and big industry to stop ocean desalinization, and a CDC advisory panel recommends restricting access to the MMRV vaccine. What would that have meant for Texas during the measles outbreak?
It would have been thousands and thousands of children with measles, and I hate to think how many more deaths we might have seen.
Support for this podcast of Texas Matters comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company. By investing in local communities and rewarding policyholders for prioritizing safety, they are building a more resilient Texas. More at texasmutual.com/texansgetit. Texas Mutual. Texans get it.
This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. The Inner Harbor Desalinization Plant was proposed to produce a seawater drinkable supply for Corpus Christi, especially to serve a growing industrial demand. Petrochemical companies and other industry in the coastal area need a lot of water, and they were already using the lion's share of the Corpus Christi municipal water supply. The city of Corpus is in a water crisis. It's in stage 3 water restrictions right now. Desal was being floated as the best solution, but it is expensive. The project had ballooned from earlier estimates to about $1.2 billion, with residential users expected to pay a large share of it with a 20% water rate increase. Recently, at a very long, emotionally charged city council meeting, many residents and environmental advocates spoke out against the project. Major concerns included the high cost, fiscal risk, environmental damage, and unequal benefits. But it was the cost concerns that eventually killed the project. There was pressure from the state officials pushing for desal, seeing this technology as a long-term partial solution for the growing water needs for the state. For example, Governor Greg Abbott's office had supported the project and provided some funding. But council members who opposed it said that despite the political pressure, the financial and broader risk were just too large. Scrapping the Inner Harbor project is seen as a major victory for Corpus Christi community organizers who maintained pressure throughout the decade-long planning process. They succeeded by mobilizing public testimony, framing environmental stakes, and focusing on transparency and fiscal accountability. Their strategy included showing how cost had escalated, how jobs and other claims of benefits were unclear, and insisting on alternatives. The large public engagement shifted the political balance, making it politically costly for officials to support the plan seen as risky and burdensome. Beatrice Alvarado and Jake Hernandez are lead organizers for the Texas Campaign for the Environment, Water for People, Not Polluters operation.
Yeah, I think as many organizers have said, this is a decade in the making, a win that's been a decade in the making. Although this win wasn't fully on our terms, we still celebrated. There's definitely a lot more work to be done, and I think that's at the core of organizing. This fight started to end industrial expansion in our area, considering the issues we were experiencing due to encroachment by industry. And so there's still a ways to go to really truly achieve water for people, not polluters, in the long run.
Jake, tell me more. How did this happen? What were the factors that led to this?
Well, when it really came down to it, the reasoning behind the city council's votes on the desal plant was because of the cost. The cost had gone up several times over the course of the years as the desal plant was being planned. And its most recent cost estimate had jumped up to $1.2 billion, which was a lot higher than the expected $757 million that we had been expecting the plant to cost for quite a while for now.
The cost factor, but there are plenty of other arguments, Beatrice, particularly the health of the harbor, so the environmental impact, who was going to pay the cost. That's the other issue, that this was going to be on the backs of the residential ratepayers, when this was something that was mainly going to benefit industry in the area. Were those factors?
Right. I think community organizing played a huge role in informing folks that despite what the city was saying, that this was going to be for residents, it was actually going to be for industry. That's how this plan originated back in, you know, conversations in council in 2014. Word got out that this was going to be for industry. And I think the culminating factor, like Jake said, was the cost. And by proxy, how it would be funded, which would be through our debt, our city debt and our utility payments. So I think that played a huge role in participation from the public. But overall, the council themselves, their votes really, despite all of the ecological costs that we have been bringing to light for years, despite the harm against Hillcrest and the encroachment there, they were still going to move forward. It seemed like for, you know, all the way through. But it was the cost that really was the catalyst for the votes that we needed. So, yeah, overall, the residents participated enough to really sway some of the politics. But we still, like I said, have a ways to go to really achieve what we set out to do.
So getting the residents to participate in a way that where the city council had to take a clear-eyed look at the costs and the benefits, all these things. So, Jake, community activism, what role did it play in ending this project?
The sustained pressure that residents were able to keep up is ultimately what ended up being the demise of the plant because there were so many delays after such a long period of time. When people organize in their community and start building relationships and building trust, they're able to kind of cut through a lot of the, you know, a lot of the misinformation and a lot of the kind of false narratives that were built up around ESOL. And so people were, you know, able to make their voices heard to officials that are in power. And that community organizing led to all these delays, which ended up leading to the plant, you know, being shut down.
Beatrice, when I covered this story last year, it seemed like the number that I was working with on how much the cost for this project was $1.2 billion. That number was already out there. Why were they trying to act like this is a new number? Even the $1.2 billion for the overall cost, not even looking at the maintenance, which was going to run into the tens of millions of dollars per year, was that hidden from the public?
Yeah, I think the city went a certain way in terms of revealing that. I remember early on, like you said, those figures were presented to council, including that took into account inflation in the years that it would be coming online. But it wasn't officiated in any way. And that's really been the mainstream narrative that has been perpetuated and reaches most people here in Corpus, either through the city and the news. Community organizing early on spotted it, or advocates early on spotted it and did what they could to get the word out. But it wasn't until that price was made official by the city and the contractor that it really kind of got everyone shook.
And then the cost that was going to be passed along to the ratepayers, it looked like if this had gone through, that it would have been about a 20% increase on what people would be paying for water if you were a typical residential user. And even that number seemed low. Did that seem to be something that changed the narrative when people learned that factor, Jake?
It was definitely a concern for a lot of people. So Beats and I did, you know, like a lot of outreach to people leading up to the vote in city council. Lots of people were concerned about the prospect of their water bills going up, the prospect of their property taxes and their electricity bills going up. So a lot of people were able to see through, you know, all these like other consequences that this plant might actually have some legitimate concerns behind it.
And so, Beatrice, you've talked about there's more to be done. What else needs to be done?
Yeah, just I think on that tangent, people are realizing that we're being fined for using too much water. We're being asked not to water our lawns while industry is actually exempt from drought restrictions. They pay a fee to continue pulling during drought stages. And I think some folks are waking up to that. Ultimately, we want to be able to have leadership that doesn't sell all our resources, all of our natural resources, to the Valeros and the Exxons, and to co-govern moving forward as the political landscape gets more tumultuous. I think it's going to be really important for us to achieve that in the coming years.
Jake, the story of Corpus Christi and the community organizing on the Inner Harbor desal plant, this is not just really a local story, because this is something that's happening across the state. We're seeing a big industry, AI, using more and more water as an example. And we're seeing, you know, the scarcity of water across the state of Texas becoming a major concern, and that these giant AI mega corporations are getting cut rate deals in order to use that water. That's impacting residences and impacting agriculture. So should people be looking at what happened in Corpus Christi, the community organizing that happened there, about how we should be having community conversations about our water and who gets to have it and who has to pay for it?
Absolutely. Unfortunately, organizers all across the Gulf South know all too well the fight that we've just gone through. You know, their fights may not be with desalination plants, but there's countless other cities and small towns in Texas and Louisiana, and across the country, but that have to deal with this kind of industrial expansion in their communities. So yes, it's wildly important for communities to start building relationships, start building trust, and start building power with each other. Because you can't always trust your officials in power. And also, you know, we're the cards are stacked against us. The oil and gas industry is one of the biggest industries in the United States, and in Texas especially. So it really, really takes a lot of sustained effort and a lot of like intentional relationship building to get to a point like where we were at, because, you know, again, this has been a process that's been going on for years and years, but it was only possible through really, really strong community building.
And what would you say, Beatrice, was the big lesson learned that other people, other communities can take from what happened in Corpus?
I think claiming wins, for sure. being able to claim a win when we achieve it. But persisting, moving forward, and not deviating from our values, our core values, I think has been the strongest lesson from this win in particular.
Beatrice Alvarado and Jake Hernandez are lead organizers for the Texas Campaign for the Environment, Water for People, Not Polluters operation. On Thursday, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's Advisory Panel on Vaccines voted to weaken recommendations for a measles vaccine that includes protections against the varroa or chickenpox virus. They're saying the vaccine, called MMRV, shouldn't be recommended for children under the age of 4 because of a small risk for seizures in that age group. The seizures can be prompted by fevers associated with the viruses. Doctors say that while they are scary for parents to witness, they are generally harmless. It's unknown if this recommendation will result in a policy change at the CDC, but supporters of vaccines are alarmed. Terry Burke says this recommendation could have had tragic consequences for Texans, given the fact that the state had just endured the worst outbreak of measles in 30 years. Burke is the executive director of the Immunization Partnership.
What they did yesterday was they decided to remove the recommendation for the MMRV at 12 months and moved it, the recommendation to the first shot being at 4 years of age. The meeting yesterday was confusing. It was hard at times to know what they were saying or doing. What they have done now is they're really sowing confusion and deepening the distrust in science and evidence with this.
So they're objecting to just the chickenpox part of the MMRV, right?
I mean, again, I don't, I'm not sure.
I mean, so, I mean, can they just take that part? I'm worried about things like the measles part of the MMR.
Right, right.
Because we just had the measles outbreak here in Texas. And if we had a population of kids who had not gotten measles shots in before the age of four, then we would have had a much bigger and much more tragic outcome, I would think.
Yes, we would have. I mean, we believe strongly that that's the case. And so, but here, what they're suggesting is that putting this this four shot combination together is troublesome to them, I guess. Their words are stronger, but this has been around now for 20 years. The MMR has been around for 50, but they added varicella to it about 20 years ago. And there's a lot of thinking that, you know, I mean, we all know kiddos don't want shots. So if you can put them all into one shot, that way they don't have four shots.
And for parents, too, you know, try and make it easier to get the shots.
That's right. And so, you know, there's been a lot of talk. I mean, I've heard it. Parents who say, oh, you know, I'm so worried about little Susie getting so many shots, et cetera. And you know, that's understandable. And it's something parents can talk to their pediatricians about. But this is putting four shots in one.
And it's been proven to work.
It's been proven to work over, I mean, 20 years it's been working. You know, it's just absurd that we're going through this, to be honest.
Okay, but so if they recommend taking out the varicella part of the MMRV shot, how does that disrupt everyone else from getting the MMR part of it? Will they be able to easily remove the varicella from that shot cocktail? Or is that just, are people going to have to, or they'll just wait for the comprehensive shot until they're four, and then we have complications?
Right. I mean, my understanding, and of course they're meeting again today, so things, I guess, could change. My understanding is that they're recommending the entire shot, the MMRV, not happen until the child is four. So I'm not seeing that they're saying, oh, give them the MMR at 12 months. I don't think this is entirely about the varicella part of the vaccine.
What does that mean? Okay, let's say this becomes the policy. Now, we have other groups like the American Academy of Pediatrics saying, don't do that. We recommend that you give this shot at 12 months. And now we have the Center for Disease Control saying something different. And insurance companies and pharmacists and state lawmakers, who are they going to pay attention to? This is mass confusion.
It is. That's absolutely right. I mean, one of our concerns has been the Vaccines for Children program. There was some discussion yesterday. This was part of the confusion, but there was some discussion yesterday about recommendations for VSC versus everybody else. But we're very concerned that removing this recommendation will result in the removal of vaccine coverage through Vaccines for Children. And then that in turn can affect commercial insurance coverage. Now, let me say, the Health Insurance Association of America, whatever it's called, has come out and said that they're not going to stop paying for vaccinations for children. The American Academy of Pediatricians has put out their recommendations, and then there's SIDRAP in Minnesota that's doing theirs. So I think for the moment, I think what we anticipate is chaos. And there will be states, you've seen the stories about Washington and Oregon and those states on the West Coast and Massachusetts and others on the East Coast getting together to put together their own recommendations and plan and make those the guidance for their programs. So, but, you know, Texas is not a place where we tend to, if the feds take away the money, we don't replace it. So the Vaccines for Children program comes to us through the federal government. It does require some state money, but federal government money is the largest part of it. And therefore, you know, he who has the money gets to make the rules.
Had this rule been in place during our measles outbreak in Texas, what would that have looked like?
I think it would have looked 10 times worse. I mean, you know, we've pointed out repeatedly, and I think I've talked to you about this, is that Gaines County, where it started, had a 18% non-medical exemption rate among kindergartners, five-year-olds, basically. And so that's where this outbreak started. We got to 750 cases and that could be traced to Gaines County in some way. So just think about that. You've got how many children under four in this state, and you know, how, I mean, what, so if it were 19% of all the children under four in Texas who weren't vaccinated, yeah, it would have been thousands and thousands of children with measles. And I hate to think how many more deaths we might have seen.
Terry Burke is the executive director of the Immunization Partnership. For several months, ICE agents have detained people who show up for immigration court. It's happening across the country. In El Paso, faith leaders and volunteers attend the hearings to offer comfort and assistance to migrants, asylum seekers, and their families. As KETP's Angela Kacherga reports, the group has also started a weekly prayer vigil.
When I arrive, about three dozen people are gathered in a circle outside the federal building that houses immigration courtrooms. Reverend Marta Pomeroy with the Tres Rios Presbyterian Border Foundation leads this week's prayer vigil.
This is happening across our country, and this is something we need people of all faiths and all traditions to show up, to stand up.
Showing up here, young and old, advocates and everyday people. All volunteers like Bonnie Daniels.
I'm a fronteriza, born and raised in El Paso, Texas.
As a native of the border, Daniels says it's a calling to bear witness to those who have hearings in immigration court.
There were people here who cared, who know them by name, who held their hand, comforted them, and did what we can to assist them through this awful ordeal that's going on right now.
ICE agents, often wearing masks, wait in the hallways outside courtrooms to detain people when their cases are dismissed. Many immigrants are distraught after learning their fate. During the vigil, volunteers share what they've seen. Daniels talks about a man facing deportation to Venezuela who asks how to get to the roof of the seven-story building.
And he says, I want to go to the top and jump. Thankfully, the nuns, of course, talked him out of it.
Sister Leticia Gutierrez Valderrama was one of those nuns. She's the director of the Migrant Hospitality Ministry of the Diocese of El Paso.
Porque la gente, la fe no la deja.
Sister Gutierrez says people don't lose their faith. Instead, they ask God to be with them during their immigration hearings. Along with spiritual support, the nuns and other volunteers provide practical help, including making sure relatives have contact information so they can find and track their loved ones after they're detained by ICE. Reverend Sandra Jones, deacon at St. Christopher's Episcopal Church, says the moment they're separated is the most painful for families.
That surprise is the hardest thing to see. It's really hard to see that they're being taken. We don't know where they're going. We don't know when we'll see them again.
Volunteer Deanne Croucher brings toys and coloring books for the children waiting outside the courtroom for a parent. She says when the hearing is over and ICE moves in, it can be confusing for the kids.
And even when the mom breaks down crying and they're taking her away and the children are marching by her side, I don't think they really understand what's happening either.
Some children face immigration court hearings of their own. Croucher remembers a little girl accompanied by her mother.
And of course she had dressed her up. She looked like she was going to Easter Sunday in her little white dress and her little white shoes. And the order was for the child to appear, a three-year-old. Well, of course they didn't detain her, but we never know. We don't know.
In Jesus' name we pray.
At the weekly vigil, there are prayers for migrants, people seeking asylum, and their families. But Reverend Pomeroy says the gathering is also for the volunteers who see the human toll at immigration court.
Having people speak about it and watch it and witness it and share those stories starts restoring and building that humanity back.
Lives won't be divided, right? I'm Angela Kocherga in El Paso.
In Dallas, there is a similar outcry. KERA's Priscilla Rice reports on a group of volunteers there who are showing up to court to document and share what is happening there.
The 4th and 10th floors of the federal courthouse building in downtown Dallas are reserved for immigration hearings, such as asylum cases, adjustment of status, or removal proceedings. Since April, they've also been the site of clashes between migrants and immigration officials, there to arrest people directly after their hearings. This video taken in the hallway outside a courtroom shows a man walking out of his hearing and being detained by five ICE agents dressed in plain clothes. They throw him to the floor as they arrest him, then take him behind two double doors. It all happens within seconds. That voice you hear is Noemi Rios. She's been coming to immigration hearings for months, documenting arrests. She says incidents like these are a daily occurrence.
Folks are showing up, doing the right thing, showing up for their court hearing, only to be apprehended in the hallways, and no notifications to their families of what's happening to them.
KERA reached out to Immigration and Customs Enforcement to ask about the arrest and what the agency's policy is, but didn't hear back. Rio started her group Vecinos Unidos DFW, Neighbors United, she says, to keep an eye on the courts and what's happening behind closed doors.
You can see their eyes, and it's heartbreaking because we can't do more than document, observe, and educate and empower the community to bring more folks out.
Rios partners with churches and other places of worship to teach other volunteers how to be court observers, how they should identify themselves to judges, where they can take photos and videos, and how to handle interactions with ICE officers.
We want folks to feel safe and go in numbers.
Mara Richards-Bim is a justice and advocacy fellow at Royal Lane Baptist Church, where Rios recently led a training. Bim says it's important for people in the faith community to get involved like this.
I think it is also an opportunity for people who have that kind of privilege to really use it in a way that protects other people and other people who really need protecting right now.
Rio says the volunteers play three crucial roles. They monitor interactions between migrants and ICE officers, document court proceedings, and generally provide support. Most of the people she teaches have never set foot in the federal court building before.
A lot of people do not even know that this is currently going on.
Victor began volunteering with Rios' group in August. He asked that we not use his full name.
I am a first-generation American here in the United States. Both of my parents are illegals. So yeah, I feel like it's very important that we should shed light on what's going on inside the courtrooms.
The actual court personnel. And or
is that an abduction that's happening right now?
On a recent visit to the courthouse, Victor and a handful of volunteers witnessed as one man was arrested by plainclothes ICE agents.
And all you could hear is this gentleman screaming out, crying for help in Spanish. You could hear the thumps of ICE agents taking him down.
Do you hear that?
Go,
go,
go.
It's hard to watch, Rio says, but she feels a responsibility to be here.
I think at the bare minimum, by achieving bigger numbers, is these things aren't happening in secret. And so things aren't swept under the rug.
I'm Priscilla Rice in Dallas.
That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can email us at texasmatters@tpr.org. You can find us wherever you download cool podcasts. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.